In the coming week, the Winter Olympics kick off in Beijing. Leaders of the African Union convene in Addis Ababa, and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz makes his first visit to the White House. It's February 3rd, 2022, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, it's the highly anticipated event of the winter. That's the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. Like the 2021 Summer Olympics in Tokyo, it's happening under a COVID cloud. But Jim, can you tell us a little bit about the aspects of this Olympics that we need to watch for as things kick off in the next day or so?
Certainly, Bob. And let me begin by saying that when athletes are greeted by people in full body hazmat suits, you know, these are not the winter games the Chinese imagined they would be holding when they won the right to host them back in 2015. COVID has changed everything. China is the only country in the world still trying to implement a zero COVID strategy. So we have seen the Chinese shut down not just neighborhoods, but entire cities and keep them under lockdown. The challenge Chinese authorities are facing have only grown as the coronavirus has mutated. The two vaccines developed by Chinese companies were only moderately effective against earlier variants of the coronavirus, and they look to be largely ineffective against the Omicron variant. So the Chinese population is very vulnerable. And you can see how bringing in thousands of athletes from around the world would pose a significant risk. The Chinese authorities have responded by creating bubbles around the three Olympic sites. The estimated 61,000 people inside those bubbles are going to be tested daily. Attendance at the games is going to be restricted. There'll be very few foreign spectators, and the various venues are expected to have only about 30 to 50% of their seats occupied. Even with these restrictions, nearly 300 Olympic competitors, coaches, and other staff have tested positive in the last 10 days, either upon arrival at Beijing's airport or inside of one of the bubbles. So there's a pretty good chance that some of the competitions are going to be disrupted. Indeed, the ice hockey competition has already been affected by the NHL's decision back in December not to allow its players to participate because of Beijing's onerous quarantine protocols. The games are also different than prior ones because ties between China and the West have clearly frayed. Geopolitics is intruding on the Olympic Games. The United States and eight other countries, including Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom, are declining to send their diplomats to the games to protest China's human rights abuses. One thing to keep an eye on in the days to come is whether we're going to see spontaneous or organized protests by the competitors themselves. There has been talk in recent days that some of the competitors may organize boycotts of either or both the opening and closing ceremonies. And of course, outside of China, there are sporadic efforts going on to try to get consumers to boycott the companies that are sponsoring the Olympics. Now, none of this seems to have fazed the Chinese government. Unlike in 2008, when Beijing hosted the Summer Olympics, China hasn't made any promises to improve its human rights records or offer up any other inducements to the United States or other countries. The Beijing Organizing Committee has said that athletes that violate the International Olympic Committee's rules in order to protest could be punished under Chinese law. And as our colleague Yanjiang Wang wrote in a piece that came out in today's Washington Post, Beijing's municipal government has gone as far as to replace English words in the city's subway system with pinyin that few foreigners understand. And perhaps the clearest indication that China intends to do things its way, Bob, is that Xi Jinping is set to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin just before the opening ceremony. This will be Xi's first in-person meeting with a fellow world leader in 2 years. And while the United States and Europe may be alarmed at Putin's actions toward Ukraine, China is welcoming him with open arms.
So, Jim, I was hoping to get excited about the games, but after hearing your setup there, I'm not sure what I should get excited about. Obviously, when the sports start happening, things take care of themselves. But it is so much more than sports, as always. And this year in particular, it just seems like the backdrop is just unavoidable, especially if you compare it just to 4 years ago when you had the Winter Olympics in South Korea and you had this opening of this rapprochement with North Korea as a major backdrop. Hey, the Olympics can be this gateway into fellowship and, you know, peace peace among nations. It just seems like anything but. And I would note that our sister podcast, Why It Matters, had an episode devoted to the Olympics and the sort of the role they play in soft power. Our other colleague who writes about China, Ian Johnson, notes this might be an Olympics the Chinese leaders wish would go away rather than invite it for its soft power potential.
Well, I do think the Chinese are worried about the Olympics precisely because of the potential threat of the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus, because China clearly is vulnerable on that score. I also think that any hopes the Chinese had that the Olympics would be a positive branding message for Chinese culture, Chinese way of life, Chinese system, those have probably been dashed. And they've been dashed largely because of China's ham-handed actions on lots of other issues. And this is true of populations around the world. If you look at public opinion polling, you see that in many countries, China's favorability ratings have plunged over the last several years. So I don't think that having a games, even one that comes off very well and avoids protests, avoids a big outbreak of COVID, is going to really change that narrative, because perceptions of China are really fundamentally being driven at the moment by Chinese actions. And in many countries around the world, this is not just the United States, people have reacted badly to China's assertion of its new global power.
So it comes back to, I guess, just the games themselves. We'll see how the athletes perform. We'll see if there's any sort of rivalry that emerge. And maybe through the burner phones that some of the Western athletes are going to be acquiring, we'll see some selfies and other interesting shots taken from the venues.
Well, I have to ask you, Bob, are there any sports you're particularly interested in watching? Are you a half pipe guy? Are you into ice dancing, professional hockey? What is it that you're looking forward to, if anything?
Not yet a half pipe guy, would like to be, and not sure my teenage daughters are into it yet. And I know they're supposed to be into that, but I would say that there's always a few I turn to in the Winter Olympics, and I dating myself back to the Wide World of Sports era of the 1970s, Jim.
Oh, you just dated both of us, Bob.
Yes. I know you'll understand this, but I have a soft spot for the jumping, the ski jumping competitions. And, a lot of the skiing I continue to like a lot, you know, downhill and the slalom. And then there's the giant combined and all the other ones that they've come up with. I tend to like those more and more. I tend to really appreciate, you know, what goes into those. And then, of course, it's the when it gets down to it, you get the figure skating, the men's, the women's, the pairs and so forth. There's always some compelling storyline. It's just a fascinating insight and a bit of drama crystallized into 2 or 3 minutes.
Well, I have to say, Bob, for people who don't get the Wide World of Sports reference, Google the opening promo. You'll understand why for a certain generation.
The agony of defeat is
ski jumping is something to watch. I like the ski jumping as well. I like watching the luge. I think that's crazy. But I actually like watching curling, and I'm hoping that as I watch my 8th or 9th Winter Olympics, I will finally figure out what all the rules are of curling. So I'll make that confession.
Please share that with me, Jim, when you do, because I'm still a little bit mystified. But and I should add bobsledding too. I've always liked bobsledding.
Bob, let's shift gears and talk about the African Union. It is set to hold its annual Head of State Summit meeting in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. This coming meeting is coming ahead of the AU's 20th anniversary this July. It has certainly been a turbulent year throughout the continent of Africa. We have seen coups in a number of countries, Chad, Guinea, Mali, Sudan, just last month in Burkina Faso. And just this week, there was a failed coup in Guinea-Bissau. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres referred to an epidemic of coup d'etats while recently discussing Africa. So as we enter this annual AU meeting, Bob, what are some of the priorities for the organization in 2022?
Well, Jim, I think as the AU seeks to mark its 20th anniversary in a significant way, I think it's going to try to double down on its first principles of trying to play a role in continental peace and security and being a crisis manager for the continent and taking on more of the burden of crisis management, peacekeeping, what have you, from the international actors that have typically played a bigger role, whether it's lead nations like France or whether it's organizations like the United Nations. African Union would like to play more of a prominent role. More recently, some of the nations you mentioned, its role has been suspending them. You've had Burkina Faso suspended from all activities in response to the military coup. You've had Mali and Guinea also suspended last year after military coups. Some other nations have not not been suspended, but the AU is trying to deal with them. The host country itself is dealing with still an ongoing, at the moment, somewhat low simmering civil war, but still an awful situation, especially a humanitarian situation in the north, in the Tigray region of Ethiopia, where there is an unsettled situation involving the Tigrayans and the central government and the government of Abiy. And so it's really about, I think, the African Union and the countries collectively coming together and saying, okay, what are we dealing with here? How are we going to get governance back in the agenda? We should note also that, and I'm sure it'll come up at the summit, that a number of the countries you mentioned and the areas where coups have taken place or been threatened have been in the western part of the continent, have been on the fringes of the Sahel, where jihadist forces have been posing serious threats that have posed threats to civilian governments that have caused, in a number of cases, military officers to step in and say, enough is enough. We need to try to get a hold of the situation. So I think there might be some more discussion of that, especially as France looks to be lightening its role, its military role in trying to fight against jihadist forces, especially in Mali. So there's that aspect, Jim. There's a chance for the African Union also, though, to note some positive things. It's been able to galvanize a fairly successful COVID-19 response. It's made some steps on financing and development, on building consensus on UN reforms. So there's some areas where they can point to success, but they have if you go from country to country, the list just gets longer and longer. It's dealing with a strategy for Libya in terms of returning foreign fighters that have come into Libya and have caused problems there. Libya is still trying to hold elections in the first part of this year. It's dealing with transition in Sudan, securing a ceasefire in Ethiopia, as I mentioned, trying to reform an African Union mission in Somalia. African Union has played an important role in that country, which had so recently been just an utter failed state. So these are huge issues. The organization is dealing with those. It's also going to be dealing with an issue that could end up becoming a real dividing line. We'll have to pay attention to it, which is just a clash over Israel's observer status. An AU official decided to extend Israel observer status. That caused some African Union members, such as Algeria and Sudan, to push back and call for discussion of this. And you could have some rancor over this decision. African Union nations like to point out that they support cause of the Palestinians, and some see that as that having Israel as an observer is somehow working against that support. But there are any number of observer nations, accredited nations to the AU, including, I saw one report today, North Korea is among them. So one would think that as Israel continues to expand its ties in the continent, that it can have AU status like it did with its predecessor organization, the Organization for African Unity. Jim.
Bob, on this issue of coup d'etats in Africa, is there much that the AU can do about it? I take your point about suspending membership, but I'm not sure what practical consequences that has, whether it provides any real leverage or it's mostly symbolic shaming.
It depends on the country involved, but it goes beyond symbolic shaming, especially when it's coupled with organizations like ECOWAS, which is a Western African regional organization, which can freeze trade ties and important sort of financial ties for some of these countries.
Yeah, and ECOWAS is actually having an emergency meeting right now to discuss what to do about Burkina Faso.
So it goes beyond the symbolic to sort of really hardcore issues that deal with the lifeblood of these countries, or at least the elites in these countries, Jim. So one of the ways the African Union has been successful has been trying to tie these issues to issues like sanctions or to not just recognition, but recognition in a way that opens up business ties. It has, again, it was making some gradual progress in some countries. I think Zambia is held up as an example where there have been peaceful transfers of power. There was a few others. But again, the spate of coups this year points to the real, I think, kind of tricky state and weak state of a number of African nations, Jim. And so it's a gut check moment, pardon the expression, for the organization, but also for the continent in terms of how it regards what it sees as threats and whether the lead nations can play a role. I mean, another lead nation in the African Union has been Nigeria. Nigeria has many of its own problems, including with anti-government forces fighting in certain parts of the country that are almost lawless. Ethiopia was supposed to be this big champion of African Union events, obviously being the host country. But again, it's got to sort out its own serious domestic problems. There's hope South Africa can help step forward. But, so I think it's an African Union leaders meeting like few others, Jim. And it's going to, I really think, set the tone for the year that's supposed to be this celebratory anniversary year.
Yeah. And certainly when you look at issues of coups in Africa and the spate we've seen over the last 12 months, you mentioned that they're tied to state state fragility, economic troubles, but obviously to the problem of jihadist terrorism. We see this across the Sahel and in Western Africa. And then you get into questions of what is it that allows those groups really to take root, take hold, and present such a challenge to central government. So these are very complicated issues, which don't seem to lend themselves to easy off-the-shelf solutions.
Absolutely. And again, the African Union itself has tried to move the continent from this sort of basket case of the world where, you know, constantly dealing with conflict and crisis and humanitarian woes, and also a place where rich countries can come in and sort of organize resource extraction and trying to kind of engineer its own affairs. Again, it's got a really important moment coming up, though. Jim, I want to move us to a discussion of the United States and German relations, which is reaching a crucial moment. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is making his first visit as chancellor to the White House in the coming week. A statement from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Olaf Scholz and President Biden will discuss the ongoing efforts to deter Russian aggression against Ukraine, as well as efforts against the COVID-19 pandemic, climate change, and other topics. So, Jim, how do we think these talks are going to unfold?
Bob, I suspect these talks are going to be mostly about the first topic you mentioned, Ukraine, a lot less about COVID and climate change. This meeting, which was organized fairly quickly, looks to be an effort to try to tamp down on speculation that significant daylight is developed between Washington and Berlin and other European countries over how to respond to the Ukraine crisis. A lot of this has to do with the fact that Germany refuses to send lethal aid to Ukraine and has blocked Estonia from sending German-made arms as well to Ukraine. Now, the Germans have said we're sending 5,000 military helmets as a signal that we stand by Ukraine. Kyiv's mayor called the gesture a joke. The Latvian defense minister last week decried Germany's immoral and hypocritical relationship with Russia. So there are clearly tensions in the transatlantic relationship. It's not just between the two sides of the Atlantic, but also within Europe as well. Now, some of this reflects different interests, different policies. The Germans have had a longstanding policy of not sending lethal aid into war-torn countries. So the Germans just say this is a standing policy that we're following. But you also have, you know, different interests and different assessments. Now, obviously, in life, your interests can influence your assessments. I think many Germans would argue that they think a large-scale Russian invasion is unlikely. What you're more likely to see is prolonged efforts to destabilize Ukraine, to sort of create a situation of uncertainty that makes it hard for the Zelensky government to deliver, and that will sort of undercut the development of a more stable, more pro-Western Ukraine, which is precisely what Vladimir Putin fears. So I would imagine the president and the chancellor are going to see if they can come up with a common script that will emphasize how much they share in common in their assessments, in their concerns, and try to take the focus away from where they disagree or where they have contending views.
Jim, I take the point about, you know, Germany having this longstanding policy of not wanting to send weapons or enable weapons into war zones. I recall living in Germany in the 1990s, they've still very strongly held pacifist views and views about sending German forces abroad. That was since loosened and as Germans took part in some of the missions in Afghanistan, for example. But it's still really important. At the same time, Germany continues to be the primary country of basing U.S. forces, and it's an important base. And some of those forces we just heard this week are going to be sent to Romania and Poland to help shore up NATO forces there as part of the ongoing kind of, I don't know if it's a chess match of sorts, but just certainly the balancing of tensions going on between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine. But I wonder whether we're going to hear discussion, Jim, this week about realistic assessments of whether Germany could get energy supplies from countries not named Russia to help it deal with its concerns.
We certainly are going to, Bob, and those conversations have already been ongoing. I mean, you're alluding to the fact that Germany depends upon Russia for more than 50% of its natural gas more than a quarter of its oil. Obviously, if you lose access to oil or gas, that can throw your economy into a ditch. The problem is that it's very hard to pivot quickly to new sources of energy. And again, part of this dependence has come about in Germany because of a desire to, one, deal with climate change, move away from relying on coal-fired power plants. Also because of Fukushima, a disaster back in 2011, which led the Germans to move away from nuclear energy. Well, when you start taking certain energy sources offline, that limits what you can do. And the Biden administration has been in discussions with the Qataris to talk about other ways that Qatar can get liquid natural gas, LNG, to Germany or to the continent.
And it's important to note natural gas is soon to be designated by the EU as a green source of energy, which is very important to the Germans as well, partly because part of their coalition is the Green Party, but also in doing away with nuclear, which had zero carbon emissions, that they were doing away with an important source of green energy.
Yeah, certainly. So there are a lot of decisions taken over the last decade that sort of take us to this position which the Germans have a significant vulnerability. Now, I will note that there are a lot of people both inside Germany and outside Germany that have been telling the government in Berlin, back when it was headed by Chancellor Merkel, that this was going to come back to haunt Berlin and they should avoid it. And here you get into the conversation about Nord Stream 2, again, the pipeline going from Russia directly to Germany, which would make the Germans even more dependent upon Russian natural gas, which obviously gives the Russians leverage in a crisis. And so I would imagine part of what the conversation will be between the president and the chancellor will focus on if we do see the Russians invade Ukraine. Now, how to define that is going to be a matter of, I think, some conversation. What is Germany willing to do? Is Germany willing to walk away from Nord Stream 2? And again, for the chancellor, this is both a geopolitical issue, the future of Europe, but it's also a bread and butter domestic issue because it's going to drive things like the cost of energy, employment, and it'll have major ripple effects. So this is, you know, where the global and the local come together. So I think this is going to be particularly difficult. And again, what we don't know, we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, is what decisions the Russians are going to make, right? And until we know that, we don't know how this is all going to play out. One thing to flag is that Chancellor Scholz just announced that he intends to go to Moscow soon to speak with Vladimir Putin. Now, I would imagine with that announcement, the part of the conversation between Biden and Scholz will be over what it is Scholz should say. And here the Germans are in a difficult position because obviously if a number of your allies, and again, not just the Americans, some European allies are very concerned about Germany going wobbly, the chancellor will need to be very careful in any conversation he has with President Putin.
And as we've discussed before, much was made about the ability of Angela Merkel to kind of speak frankly with Putin in either Russian or German. And they seem to have, if not always a rapport, at least an understanding of the big issues of the day.
They certainly do. And there's no reason to believe that Scholz has that kind of rapport with Putin or will be able to establish it. And that'll be another part of the human dynamic of all of this, because there's reason to believe that Vladimir Putin is not just looking at Ukraine as a Ukrainian issue, but as part of a bigger drama in Europe. It's very clear that President Putin wants to redraw the security order in Europe. And his ultimate goal would be to break NATO. He's been very clear about that. No secret. Until this point, he hasn't had an opportunity to do so, and he may not get an opportunity to do so. But that clearly is part of his thinking.
So, Jim, not just a meeting of Germans and Americans, but with NATO and European security at stake, potentially.
That it is, Bob. I'm sure we'll return to this story in future podcasts. But for now, let's pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected 60 dead in Congo attack. What can you tell us about the audience's figure of the week?
Jim, the audience has seized on a rather grim new development of a distressingly familiar situation in eastern Congo, which is an area of rampant armed gangs and humanitarian crisis. This is an attack that the figure's referring to has been attributed to a group known as the Cooperative for Development of Congo Militia, known by the acronym CODECO. And it focused on civilians. It's an intimidation tactic. It was absolutely brutal. 60 people killed, and many of them in machete attacks, a number of others wounded. They were in a displaced person camp, which are also familiar sites in Eastern Congo because of the region's propensity for lawlessness and militias. Just a few other figures really quickly, Jim. There's something like 120 armed groups that operate in the eastern provinces of North Kivu, South Kivu, and Ituri. This attack that we're referencing in the audience figure is in Ituri. There's something like 5.5 million people internally displaced in Congo as of the end of last year, according to the UN's refugee agency. And again, this attack took place at a makeshift camp for displaced people in Ituri province. And it's shining a new light on the fact that, you know, many of the issues, many of the destabilizing issues involving Eastern Congo have not been settled. And it's another challenge facing that country. We talked about various other countries facing challenges in sub-Saharan Africa at the African Union Summit. Well, Democratic Republic of Congo has its share, given its vastness, given the spoils that are involved in certain parts of the country. We talk about, it's almost a cliche to say resource-rich Africa. Well, Congo is among the most resource-rich of any African country. It's also a country the size of Western Europe. It's gigantic. And it's a country with a very shaky sense of governance, and certainly central government control in Eastern Congo is not strong. There is a UN peacekeeping presence. I believe it's the largest UN peacekeeping presence in the world is in Congo. And so it's, again, the audience figure is a reminder of the difficult situation there.
Bob, you mentioned the group that carried out the attack is just one of many groups operating in the Eastern Congo, creating a lot of violence. Are these groups motivated by ideology? Is it ethnically or tribally based? Or are these just marauding gangs of thugs?
From the reporting I've seen, Jim, there's been a combination of all of those elements that have been driving some of these. It's at the end of the day, though, the reporting I've seen is that it's a turf issue, and they are trying to hold sway over certain areas from which certain valuable resources are extracted, and getting the sort of ransom of those resources and getting control over those. So not as we've seen in some of the other attacks and really vicious reprisals and counterattacks in the past decades in Eastern Congo that were spillovers between the Tutsi and Hutu, for example, those two groups, especially some of the groups that had fled Rwanda after the genocide in Rwanda. It's not that type of thing as much as it is a more sort of a turf thing. But again, when civilians are being killed wantonly, there's sometimes of a certain group and the militias are from another group, and it is that kind of thing. So it's not a clear-cut answer, Jim, unfortunately, but it does speak to the dire need for there to be some sort of assertion of control in the Congo and it really needing outside help.
Well, but it's clear that no one in Congo has the capacity to assert that control. And I don't see many countries willing to intervene to try to create order. And I guess the track record on trying to do that isn't that good. But sort of looking at it, then when we're talking about Congo and the violence we're seeing there, it's different than the violence we're seeing in the Sahel and in West Africa we were talking about moments ago, where it is at least ostensibly tied into Islamic jihadi extremist movements and ideology.
That is correct. This is more sort of a turf issue and a control.
More like gangs
issue.
In New York or in LA, it seems.
Exactly.
On a bigger scale.
Exactly. More of that nature. No less vicious, certainly, yep. But of a different nature.
Understood.
Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Costa Rica continues the region's string of general elections. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa delivers his State of the Nation address, and Sri Lankans celebrate Independence Day.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that the opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch and Rafaela Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.